The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today we'll be reading from The Week magazine, the best U.S. and international media. Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 21st, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump turns his guns on the GOP. What happened? GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump triggered a civil war within his own party this week after dozens of congressional Republicans announced they could no longer support his candidacy, and House Speaker Paul Ryan told his members they were free to abandon the presidential nominee and focus on their own campaigns. The exodus, which included Senator John McCain, took place after the release last Friday of a 2005 Access Hollywood video in which the GOP nominee was caught in a hot mic bragging in graphic terms about how he can do anything to women because he's a star, including grab them by the blank. Republicans had already grown concerned that Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's widening poll lead over Trump could imperil their control of the Senate and maybe even the House. And when the video emerged, lawmakers began rescinding their endorsements and calling for Trump to step aside. In response, the billionaire businessman blasted the weak and ineffective Ryan for providing him with zero support, said the shackles were off of his campaign, and promised retribution against disloyal Republicans. Several GOP lawmakers, including Senator John Tooney of South Dakota, sheepishly reversed themselves and said they'd vote for Trump after his supporters berated them as cowards and traitors. While fighting fellow Republicans, Trump also turned up his attacks on Clinton and her husband Bill. For the second presidential debate on Sunday, Trump invited as guests three women who had accused Bill Clinton of sexually assaulting them decades ago, and said what the former president did to women was far worse than his own locker room talk on the 2005 tape. He said that if he wins, he would appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Clinton's use of a private email server and put her in jail. Clinton accused Trump of living in an alternate reality and said the 2005 video represents exactly who he is. Polls suggested Clinton won the debate among all voters, but that Trump's aggressive performance helped solidify his support among Republicans. Still, the RealClearPolitics.com national poll average showed Clinton opening up a commanding lead of 6.2 points, up 2 points from last week. Polls also showed her pulling ahead in battleground states such as Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina, and even Ohio. What the editorial said. The Republican Party is undergoing a truly historic rupture, said NationalReview.com. While the timing of this open revolt is curious, were Trump's comments on the tape that much worse than anything else he had said? It is welcome nonetheless. Ryan and his colleagues must now separate themselves from their toxic nominee and focus on preserving their Senate and House majorities. It'll be a tough line to tread, as embattled down-ballot Republicans still need Trump voters. But it's essential we have a check on a potential Hillary Clinton presidency. Trump's promise to have Clinton locked up was a disturbing low in presidential politics, said the Washington Post. The unprecedented threat proves Trump would rule like an autocrat, using the power of the presidency to punish his enemies, the press, and anyone who dared oppose him. It's hardly any surprise that he continues to ally himself with Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. In the debate, Trump dismissed government intelligence reports that Russian hackers are interfering with the U.S. election, and falsely claimed that Russian and Syrian government forces are bombing ISIS, when in fact they're targeting Syrian rebels and civilians. What the columnist said. This is an absolute worst-case scenario for Republicans, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. The party originally lined up behind Trump in the hope he could be managed or brought to heel, but those efforts have failed, and now they're facing an angry, cornered, vengeful, selfish nominee. There is one silver lining, said George Will in NationalReview.com. Trump's inevitable defeat will be so ugly and complete that he can simplify the GOP's quadrennial exercise of writing its post-campaign autopsy. This year it can be summed up in one sentence. Perhaps it is imprudent to nominate a venomous charlatan. Trump isn't just a charlatan, said Will Salatin in Slate.com. He's a potential dictator who threatens journalists, wants to align the U.S. with Putin's Russia, challenges the validity of our democratic elections, encourages mob violence, and now threatens to put his political opponent in jail. All violations of critical norms. For 240 years, Americans worked, fought, and died to get us this far. We could blow it all in a day. Still, the Republicans' mass defection may backfire, said Josh Kroshauer in NationalJournal.com. Their endorse but don't defend strategy was awkward, but it was working. Most GOP House and Senate candidates were running well ahead of Trump. But if Trump loyalists now punish Republican lawmakers for abandoning ship, this could turn into a total Democratic rout. Whatever happens, this week marks the start of the Republican Civil War, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. If Trump loses, he'll inevitably blame the party for his defeat, and his supporters are already vowing vengeance. Will they sit out the 2018 midterms? And will Trump return for the 2020 election? It's too early to say, but mainstream Republicans certainly won't be able to take their party back without a fight. And a second main story on the other side of the presidential campaign. WikiLeaks emails embarrass Clinton campaign. What happened? WikiLeaks released a trove of hacked emails from Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign this week, including embarrassing and politically damaging excerpts from transcripts of the lucrative closed-door speeches she gave to Wall Street firms after leaving the State Department. One email from January, taken from the personal account of campaign chairman John Podesta, shows a staffer flagging speech excerpts that could hurt Clinton in her Democratic primary battle with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who accused Clinton of being too close to Wall Street. In a 2013 address to a Brazilian bank, Clinton said her dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders. That year at Goldman Sachs, she said that financial reform really has to come from the industry itself. In another speech, argued that politicians need a public and a private position. The hacked emails also show Chelsea Clinton expressing serious concerns about the blurring of lines between her family's foundation and the consulting company of a longtime Bill Clinton aide, Doug Band. Other messages revealed the campaign's coziness with reporters at the New York Times, CNBC, the Boston Globe, and other outlets. The WikiLeaks dump came just hours after the Obama administration formally accused Russia of trying to influence the 2016 election by stealing and disclosing emails from the Democratic National Committee and other institutions and prominent individuals. Podesta accused Moscow of also being behind the latest hack and claimed that longtime Donald Trump aide Roger Stone had received advanced warning of the leak, noting that Stone had tweeted in August that it would soon be Podesta's time in the barrel. Stone called the accusation a vile smear. What the editorial said. Now we know why Clinton never released those transcripts. They would have cost her the nomination, said the Wall Street Journal. But while Sanders' progressive supporters might argue that the leaks show Clinton to be a Wall Street crony, Our guess is that she was actually conning the bankers, angling for campaign contributions and earning her $200,000 plus speaking fees. When a presidential candidate says in public that she wants to punish banks with more regulation, but in private she says she really likes them, believe the public comments. What's most worrying is how Trump has shrugged off Moscow hacks, said the Washington Post. He is receiving classified intelligence briefings, so is aware of the evidence pointing to Russia. Yet he consistently claims that nobody really knows who's responsible and insists he'd like to get along with President Vladimir Putin. Does he propose to this collaboration out of ignorance or because of undisclosed business interests? Putin surely knows the answer to that question, but U.S. voters do not. What the columnists said. The emails reinforce conservative and leftist worst presumptions about Clinton, said Ben Wolfgang in the Washington Times. Her dream of open borders suggests she isn't committed to homeland security. Her Wall Street doublespeak exposes her as a hypocrite. It was risky to give closed-door speeches to big banks, an object of scorn for many Americans, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Fortunately for Clinton, this story broke just as Trump was caught bragging about groping women. If her opponent weren't a sexual predator, the leaks would be devastating. Bill Clinton is right that politicians need a public and a private position, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Just look at the example she used in a speech. President Lincoln's backroom machinations to pass the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery. Broadcasting negotiations in public, especially in our polarized environment, promotes posturing and is antithetical to compromise. Clinton's speeches show she can operate within the system and isn't a fantasy candidate who's going to clean up the mess in Washington. Should we rely on WikiLeaks as a source? Asked Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. If the information is authentic, we are obligated to consider it. But by promoting this material, we are encouraging more rogue behavior, consciously or not. Our best defense is to encrypt every form of private and government digital communication. We have to shut the back doors that Putin's intelligence services use to steal and publish important information, even if that means it is lost to election campaigns and high-stakes public debates. Controversy of the week. Trump. Is his, quote, locker room talk disqualifying? Donald Trump says it was only locker room talk when he bragged of forcibly kissing women and groping their private parts on that Access Hollywood tape, says Ryu Spaeth in NewRepublic.com. The grisly truth, however, is that this is hardly the first time Trump has been exposed as a misogynist. During his presidential campaign, he's repeatedly demeaned women with sexist, dehumanizing comments. He mocked Fox anchor Megyn Kelly by saying she had blood coming out of her whatever, and attacked former GOP rival Carly Fiorina's looks by saying, "Can you imagine that? The face of our next president?" He's been repeatedly accused of harassing and assaulting women. His ex-wife Ivana said Trump once yanked out a clump of her hair and raped her in a fit of rage. For a deep dive into how Trump views women, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com, just listen, if you can stomach it, to the archived hours of Trump's appearances on The Howard Stern Show. In his banter with the shock jock, Trump repeatedly rates women's looks in a 1 to 10 scale, brags of ogling and sleeping with Miss Universe contestants, and discusses his own daughter's voluptuous breast and agrees with Stern's observation that she is a piece of blank. The predatory sleazeball caught on NBC's tape is not just an act. It's who he really is. Spare me the left-wing hysteria, said Dennis Prager in NationalReview.com. How many of us can honestly say we've never made a private remark that wouldn't embarrass us if it were made public? Conservatives who are now abandoning Trump need to ask themselves, is it really worth giving the left the White House over such trivia, knowing that a president, Hillary Clinton, would install a liberal majority on the Supreme Court that would last for at least 30 years? The trumped-up outrage here is ridiculous, said Heather McDonald in cityjournal.org. The same feminists and liberals clutching their pearls over Trump's bragging about his libido argued in the 1990s that it was utterly irrelevant that President Bill Clinton exploited the power of the presidency to seduce a young intern. What's worse, Trump's words or Clinton's actions? Trump wasn't just bragging, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Numerous women over the years have come forward with tales of his sexual predation. One former business partner, Jill Harth, testified in a lawsuit that he put his hand up her dress under the table during a business dinner with her husband. Later, during a tour of his Florida estate, Harth says, Trump pushed her against a wall, kissed her, and groped her in his daughter Ivanka's bedroom. Trump denies the allegation, said John Kelly in USA Today. But it's a simple fact that Trump and his companies have been sued dozens of times for harassing and discriminating against women. He's been repeatedly accused of firing women who didn't meet his standard for attractiveness, who got pregnant, or who complained about a hostile work environment. No doubt about it, Donald Trump is a vile human being, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. But what if Democrats had to decide whether to withdraw their support for a Trump-like presidential candidate, even if it meant handing the presidency to Republicans? It's not just a theoretical question. When he was president, Bill Clinton was accused not only of philandering, but also of rape and sexual assault. Yet Democrats stuck by him because policy matters an awful lot. Now Republicans have to make that same deeply uncomfortable choice. It was a good week for Kenneth Bone, the nerdy, undecided voter in a red pullover sweater who changed the sordid tone of last week's presidential debate by earnestly questioning the candidates on their energy policies. Bone, 34, became an instant internet hero, appeared on Jimmy Kimmel, and received an offer to star in a porn film. It was a good week for ignoring the coach's advice. After Italian researchers found that having sex before sporting events has no discernible effect on athletic performance and might even have a beneficial effect. And it was a good week for spoiler alerts after Fox News commentator Mike Huckabee compared Donald Trump to the Captain Quint character in Jaws, saying that Republicans need a tough, vulgar guy to save your butt from the shark-like Hillary Clinton. I hate to be the one who'd tell you this, replied host Megyn Kelly. Captain Quint got eaten by the shark. But it was a bad week for the latest conspiracy theory. After InfoWars founder Alex Jones told his radio listeners that Hillary Clinton and President Obama are literally demon-possessed and that his sources say they both smell like sulfur. It was a bad week for Ronald McDonald after McDonald's announced that its signature character would cut way back on public appearances due to the current climate around clown sightings in communities. And it was a bad week for Second Thoughts after an Alabama man revealed in a widely shared Facebook post his deep regret for getting a Feel the Burn tattoo on his penis to support presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. It seemed like a good idea at the time, Joshua Hughes said. on the briefing page, a jihadist deadly ghost. 5 years after the U.S. killed American-born Iman Anwar al-Awlaki, he is still inspiring jihadists at home and abroad. Who was he? Anwar al-Awlaki was originally the face of moderate Islam in America. He was born in New Mexico to Yemeni immigrant parents, but his parents moved back to Yemen when he was seven, and the family didn't return to the U.S. until he was in college. He was a young man at a large mosque in the Washington suburb of Falls Church, Virginia, when the 9/11 attacks propelled him into the spotlight. The media needed Muslim leaders to respond to the attacks and to explain Islam to viewers, and the articulate and charismatic Awlaki was a natural. He gave numerous TV and newspaper interviews and even addressed an audience at the Pentagon, condemning terrorism while also criticizing U.S. foreign policy in the Muslim world. "We are the bridge between America and 1 billion Muslims worldwide," he told his followers. Why did he turn on the U.S.? The FBI started following Awlaki soon after it learned that two of the 9/11 hijackers had prayed at both his Virginia mosque and a San Diego mosque where he had preached years earlier. They found no evidence that Awlaki had any direct involvement with terrorism. But they did discover his frequent visits to prostitutes, and they kept an extensive file on those visits. Scott Shane, author of a book on Awlaki called Objective Troy, reports that the manager of one of the escort services called the imam in 2002 to warn him that the FBI knew everything. Awlaki was outraged the FBI had been surveilling him and feared he would be exposed as a hypocrite. A married man, he'd often denounced the moral decay of the West. So he quickly fled to London and later to Yemen, where he was further radicalized. By 2007, he had declared loyalty to al-Qaeda there and become the terrorist group's chief propagandist, recording sermons denouncing the U.S. and calling on Muslims to massacre Americans. In 2011, he was killed in a targeted U.S. drone strike. But Awlaki's death didn't end his influence. Who has been influenced by him? Just about every Islamist who has attacked the U.S. since 9/11. He had direct email contact with Nidal Malik Hassan, who killed 13 people in a 2000 shooting attack at Fort Hood, Texas. He helped recruit and train Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who in 2009 tried to blow up an airplane over Detroit with a bomb in his underwear. Awlaki died before the rise of ISIS, but nearly every ISIS adherent who speaks English has seen his lectures on YouTube or read his articles in Inspire, the online al-Qaeda magazine he helped launch. Saeed Rizwan Farouk, who along with his wife killed 14 people in a 2015 rampage at his workplace in San Bernardino, California, watched Awlaki sermons. So did Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz, who killed four Marines and a Navy sailor in Chattanooga, Tennessee, also in 2015. The Tsarnaev brothers, who bombed the Boston Marathon in 2013, were fans of the videos, and plans for the pressure cooker bomb they used can be found in Inspire's article, How to Make a Bomb in the Kitchen of Your Mom. Aman Khan Rahami, the man accused of planting a bomb that injured 24 people in New York's Chelsea neighborhood last month, may have followed the Inspire plans as well. And his father spoke to the FBI in 2014 because he was concerned that his son was spending so much time watching Awlaki videos. What's so seductive about those videos? Awlaki's lectures are smart and accessible. Speaking idiomatic English with just a trace of an Arabic accent, he comes across as an engaging, thoughtful preacher, not ranting, but backing up his assertions with scholarly analysis of the Quran and ample references to modern life and current politics. Most importantly, he taps into the anger many Muslims feel over the enormous civilian death toll stemming from the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, portrays Muslims as victims of Western oppression, and channels this resentment into a call for vengeance. In the notorious lecture, Call to Jihad, Awlaki calmly explains why it is the duty of every Muslim to kill Americans. Can his lectures be banned? There are thousands of hours of Awlaki lectures on YouTube alone. In 2010, under pressure from Congress, YouTube voluntarily removed hundreds of Awlaki videos, but many people have copies, and a few months later they were all back up. Software exists to find and delete child porn, and experts say a similar bot could be deployed against Awlaki's image and voice, but the government hasn't taken that step, fearing it would be a violation of the First Amendment. It's not a technical problem, says computer scientist Haney Farid. It's a policy issue. So even in death, Awlaki continues to haunt the country where he was born. The half-life of Awlaki's message is amazing, said Patrick M. Skinner, a former CIA counterterrorism officer. It really is like plutonium. It's toxic, and it doesn't go away. And we'll move on to read a few of the columns. The first two come from the U.S. Obama's premature peace prize. 7 years later, President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize is an embarrassment, said Sohrab Armani. When Obama accepted the honor after less than a year in office with trademark eloquence, the philosopher president was the toast of Europe. The Nobel Committee swooned over Obama's lofty transnationalism, whereby all states would submit to norms drawn up by law professors and global organizations, and the U.S. would retreat from its dominant role on the world stage. The results of a humbler Washington are on brutal display in Aleppo, where Syria's genocidal President Bashar al-Assad and his Russian allies, emboldened by American inaction, are setting women and children alight with incendiary ordnance. Millions of refugees fleeing Syria's violent disintegration have flooded into Europe, shattering the EU's unity. As Russian dictator Vladimir Putin expands his influence, his pilots brazenly menace the airspaces of France, Norway, Spain, and the UK. Obama and his admirers on the Nobel Committee thought that if the U.S. stopped its meddling, the world could deal with evil through diplomacy and negotiation. Now, thanks to Obama's endless patience for rogues, Europe is being destabilized and Syrians are being slaughtered. Some peace. In a second U.S. column, the GOP's future after Trump. After Donald Trump goes down to defeat, how do Republicans rebuild their party, asks David Frum. Many conservatives are arguing that the GOP needs to return to its pre-Trump principles of small government, tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy, free trade, and deep cuts in entitlement programs. But Trump's takeover of the GOP exposed the weakness of this 1980s-style conservative ideology. As awful as Trump is, as a candidate and a human being, he accurately saw that millions of Americans who do not deserve to be dismissed as bigots were sick of the happy talk about immigration, globalization, and trickle-down economics, and had become deeply pessimistic about their future. He saw that working-class voters felt abandoned by the big-money elites in both parties who control Washington. After the election, Trump voters will not suddenly decide they were wrong about all this, so Republicans had better find a way to address the real anxieties the billionaire showman cunningly exploited, which have also given rise to the Brexit and nationalist movements in Europe. The way to respond to a political tide is not to command it to halt, but to divert and channel it. And this from Poland. Our defiant women in black. We've got a revolution on our hands, said Edwin Bendyk. The problem for law and justice leader Jarosław Kaczynski, though, is that it's not the cultural revolution he desperately wanted. Since taking office last November, his right-wing, staunchly Catholic party has tried to topple our secular democracy and put the church back in the center of public life. But the government pushed too hard when it recently announced that it was considering new legislation that would have banned abortion in all circumstances, even if the pregnancy put the mother's life at risk, and that would have imprisoned women for up to 5 years for seeking an abortion. In a collective outburst of anger against an attempt to limit their basic rights, tens of thousands of women put on black clothes, boycotted work, and staged street protests in cities across Poland. Eager to quell the rage, lawmakers rejected the proposed law 352-58 just a few days later. But by that point, a progressive opposition movement had already been born. Polish women now understand that united, they can force change. Newly emboldened, they may seek to loosen Poland's existing abortion law, already one of the most restrictive in Europe, or oust politicians who support misogynistic policies. The revolution against the Law and Justice Party and all it stands for is only just beginning. And it's time for The Last Word, our in-depth article, this week titled, Exposing the Sandy Hook Hoaxers. Lenny Posner used to believe in conspiracy theories until his son's murder became one, said journalist Reeves Wademan. Now he's taking on the people who say the Sandy Hook massacre never happened. On December 14, 2012, Lenny Posner dropped off his three children, Sophia, Ariel, and Noah, at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Noah had recently turned six, and on the drive over, they listened to his favorite song, Gangnam Style, for what turned out to be the last time. Half an hour later, while Sophia and Ariel hid nearby, Adam Lanza walked into Noah's first grade class with an AR-15 rifle. Noah was the youngest of 20 children and seven adults killed in one of the deadliest shootings in American history. When the medical examiner found Noah lying face up in a Batman sweatshirt, his jaw had been blown off. It didn't take long for Posner to find out that many people didn't believe his son had died or even that he had lived at all. Days after the rampage, a man walked around Newtown filming a video in which he declared that the massacre had been staged by New World Order global elitists intent on taking away our guns. A week later, James Tracy, a professor at Florida Atlantic University, wrote a blog expressing doubts about the massacre. By January 30th, a 30-minute YouTube video titled The Sandy Hook Shooting Fully Exposed, which asked questions like, wouldn't frantic kids be a difficult target to hit, had been viewed by more than 10 million people. As the families grieved, conspiracy theorists began to press their case in ways that Newtown couldn't avoid. State officials received anonymous phone calls at their homes late at night demanding answers. Why were there no trauma helicopters? What happened to the initial reports of a second shooter? A Virginia man stole playground signs memorializing two of the victims, then called their parents to say that the burglary shouldn't affect them since their children had never existed. At one point, Posner was checking into a hotel out of town when the clerk looked up from his driver's license and said, Oh, Sandy Hook. The government did that. Lenny and Veronique Posner moved to Newtown in 2005, partly to send their kids to better schools. But after Noah's death, they saw no choice but to leave. What happened just weighed on the town like a Chernobyl-like cloud, Veronique told me from her home in a state far from Newtown that the Posners prefer not to identify. Given the threats that conspiracy theorists have leveled against some Sandy Hook families, the Posners' marriage has been falling apart before the shooting, and though Noah's death briefly brought them back together, the couple eventually divorced. Lenny lives by himself a few miles from Veronique. Since relocating, he has moved apartments four times and gets his mail delivered at a P.O. box on the other side of the state. There is no universal Sandy Hook hoax narrative, but the theories generally center on the idea that a powerful force, the Obama administration, gun control groups, the Illuminati, staged the shooting with the assistance of paid crisis actors, including the Posners, other Sandy Hook families, and countless government officials and media outlets. The children are said to have never existed or to be living in an elaborate witness protection program. Lenny may have been the first Newtown parent to discover the conspiracy theorist didn't believe his son had been killed, but because he used to be a conspiracy theorist himself. I probably listened to an Alex Jones podcast after I dropped the kids off at school that morning, Posner said, referencing the fear-mongering proprietor of InfoWars. Posner had entertained everything from specific covers-up, the moon landing was fake, to geopolitical intrigue, the real reasons why the price of gold sometimes shifts so dramatically, and saw value in skepticism. For him, the appeal of conspiracy theories was the same as that of a good science fiction movie. I have an imaginative mind, he said. Lenny had worked for two decades as an IT consultant, but after Noah was killed, he found the crisis management that the job required to be overwhelming. In the year after Noah's death, Lenny's mother died, and he and Veronique separated. People tell me it's supposed to get easier, Lenny said on the shooting's first anniversary. We're waiting for that to happen. But in the spring of 2014, as he watched the hoaxer movement bloom, Posner decided to try fighting back. He released Noah's death certificate to convince those who believed he had not been killed, and his report card. Noah is a bright, inquisitive boy, for those who believed he had never lived at all. One Friday night, a year and a half after the shooting, he joined a Facebook group called Sandy Hook Hoax, one of the more prominent hoaxer meeting grounds. Posner told the group he was there to answer questions, and he expressed his empathy with their mindset. I used to argue with people about 9/11 being an inside job, he wrote. Some members of the group asked earnest questions about inconsistencies in the official account. Others simply lobbed bombs. Posner chatted for more than 4 hours, but his patience wore thin as the questions grew more absurd. Posner was kicked out of the group, but several people contacted him with more questions. All they know is what they're seeing online, Posner said. The buzz of all of this disinformation. Posner had found his mission, and the next day he started a group called Conspiracy Theorists Anonymous, dedicated to debunking hoaxer theories. He also took his fight public, writing an op-ed in the Hartford Courant, in which he called out hoaxers by name, including Wolfgang Halbig, a 70-year-old retired school administrator in Florida. Halbig had become the hoaxer's lead investigator, filing Freedom of Information Act requests for documents relating to the shooting and posting his findings on a website called Sandy Hook Justice Report. In May 2014, Halbig spoke at a public meeting of the Newtown Board of Education. These are your children, Halbig told the board, which sat in silence. We want truth. After the meeting, Posner emailed Halbig saying that he'd like to talk to him. Halbig did not respond, but Posner said another hoaxer sent a reply. Wolfgang does not wish to speak with you unless you exhume Noah's body and prove to the world you lost your son. Halbig lives 45 minutes northwest of Orlando in a gated golf course community. Halbig says that initially Sandy Hook horrified him. He had worked in school security for a number of years, and it was only after he was asked to give a presentation to the Florida School Board Association about preventing such an attack that he began seriously investigating the shooting. 2 months after Sandy Hook, Halbig sent an email to an employee of the Newtown School District suggesting that the full story of the massacre had not been told and offering his services as a school safety consultant to investigate. The board, flooded with such emails, never responded, which Halbig took as an affront. He began making FOIA requests and peppering people in Newtown with questions. In one email, he asked Sally Cox, the school's nurse, who hid in a closet when Lanza opened fire, "Why close your eyes when you have seen blood before?" Not long after he emailed Cox, Halbig says two Florida police officers visited his home to relay a message from police in Connecticut that he risked being charged with harassment if he continued contacting people in Newtown. The incident made him a celebrity in the hoaxer world. Here was a real example, they believed, of authorities trying to silence their investigation. Halbig was far from the only active hoaxer. In 2015, James Tracy, the Florida Atlantic University communications professor, sent a letter to the Posners demanding proof that they were Noah's parents. And James Fetzer, an emeritus professor at the University of Minnesota, published a book called Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. In November, at a memorial run honoring Vicky Soto, a teacher killed at Sandy Hook, a Brooklyn man named Matthew Mills walked up to Soto's sister wearing an official T-shirt from the run and demanded that she tell him whether a family photo had been photoshopped to include Vicky, whom he believed did not exist. But Halbig has been the most persistent, and over the past 2 years, he has gone to Connecticut more than 20 times to examine documents, speak at public meetings, and attend hearings. The investigation has been financially costly to both sides. Halbig says he has raised more than $100,000 from supporters through fundraising sites, while state and local governments have had to devote significant resources to dealing with his visits and ceaseless document requests. "This is my adventure," Halbig told me in July at a diner in Newtown. Halbig was in town to review insurance claims he had requested, hoping they would show there had been no actual damage done by the shooting. By this point, he had narrowed his 16 main questions for authorities to 5. "The questions that I'm asking, they're not disrespectful to the families," Halbig said. "This is my big one. Who ordered the port-a-potties?" The vast conspiracy could be cracked, Halbig believed, if he could prove that toilets brought to the scene after the shooting had not been delivered by a local port-a-potty company hoping to be useful during a tragedy, but had instead been ordered in preparation for a staged event. If the hoaxers were going to make Posner's life even more of a hell than it had become when his son was killed, he might as well make their life hell too. He filed a complaint with the Florida Attorney General against Halbig and built a website on which he posted the personal information of various hoaxers. Last November, the HONR Network, an organization Posner established in 2015 to take down online hoaxer content, published The Hoax of a Lifetime, a 165-page ebook that treated Halbig's life much as Halbig had treated Posner's, as a hoax to be exposed. The book noted inconsistency in Halbig's record, pulled out salacious details from his personal life, and demanded that he answer the types of trivial questions he had been asking people in Newtown, like one asking why his wife's name appeared with a different middle initial on several documents. The trolled had become the troll. Posner knew that by prodding the hoaxers, he had perhaps brought more vitriol upon himself. But he denied kicking a hornet's nest. "People don't understand what trolls are," he said. "If you don't feed them, they don't just go away." One day in Newtown, I was sitting in a Starbucks when a middle-aged man, he asked me to refer to him by his email handle, Vlad the Impaler, walked up and told me he was part of a group of Newtown men, mostly fathers, who have taken it upon themselves to keep track of the hoaxers. None of the 18 men had lost a child in Newtown, and they weren't in touch with Posner. But Vlad said that he and many others privately supported Posner's crusade. Vlad said that he felt Newtown had been too polite in dealing with the hoaxers, and there was also part of him that found satisfaction in being able to retaliate. The only viable strategy, he believed, was to disrupt the hoaxers' lives. In March, a friend of Vlad sent How Big an email from relevankatrump@gmail.com, inviting him to a meeting at Mar-a-Lago where he could present the findings of his investigation for a possible use in the campaign. How Big, who is a Trump supporter, drove 3 hours to Palm Beach only to be turned away by confused security. By late August, however, it was unclear whether Halbig's campaign would last much longer. After another FOIA hearing in Hartford, in which he unsuccessfully demanded the release of police dash camera videos, Halbig lost his temper and said he was prepared to go to jail. His sit-in lasted 70 seconds, but he seemed distraught. "You have to understand, my family, they can't even go to work anymore," Halbig said. "They're scared to death." For several weeks, Vlad had been sending anonymous emails to Halbig's wife and sons and their employers, insisting that they were complicit in his harassment of grieving families. It was the first time anyone from Newtown had reached out to Halbig's family, and a few days later, Halbig shut down his website. But Posner was skeptical that Halbig would truly go away. The hoaxer problem was one the victims of tragedy would be dealing with well into the future. When I visited Halbig in June, just after the Pulse shooting in Orlando, he pulled up a blueprint of the club and asked why no security footage had been released. "It's the same players, the same method," Posner said of the conspiracy theories that now erupt after every tragedy. "The hoax thing is like a brush fire." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in New York Magazine. We're on the health and science page now. Doctors' political views affect their advice. Doctors are supposed to base their medical advice on test results, physical exams, and other empirical evidence. But new research suggests that when it comes to certain hot-button health issues, such as abortion and firearm safety, they may also be strongly influenced by their political beliefs. Researchers at Yale University selected more than 200 physicians and asked them individually to examine fictional accounts of patient encounters. For the scenarios linked to politically neutral issues such as alcohol abuse and obesity, there was little diversion of opinion among the doctors on both of the seriousness of the problem and how it should be treated. But on more sensitive topics, their reactions offered substantially. Republican doctors were particularly concerned about the scenarios involving cannabis use and abortion. They were more likely to tell patients about the dangers of weed use and advise women against having an abortion, warning they might regret it and suffer depression. Democrats, on the other hand, were more likely to encourage patients not to store guns at home, especially if they had children. Doctors need to think through these kinds of issues because if they're dealing with politically sensitive issues, this bias is unavoidable, said study author Eitan Hirsch. As a patient, it's useful to ask, is my doctor telling me this because it's what the medical evidence said or because of their worldview? Caffeine curbs dementia risk. Coffee lovers probably don't need any more encouragement to indulge in a cup of joe, but a new study suggests caffeine may help stave off dementia and other forms of cognitive impairment among older women, reports HuffingtonPost.com. Researchers tracked the brain function and caffeine consumption of 6,467 women ages 65 and older for 10 years. After considering other risk factors, including depression, smoking, heart disease, and alcohol intake, they found that women who drank the caffeine equivalent of about 3 8-ounce cups of coffee a day reduced their risk for dementia by 36%. The findings don't establish a cause and effect relationship, and it remains unclear how caffeine might help. The stimulant may block certain chemical receptors in the brain that could malfunction and impair learning and memory as people age. But Ira Driscoll, the study's author, was nevertheless encouraged by the results. The mounting evidence of caffeine consumption as a potentially protective factor against cognitive impairment is exciting, she says. Caffeine is an easily modifiable dietary factor. An estimated 5.4 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's. 1 in 3 seniors dies with some form of dementia. And we'll move right into the Talking Points page. Scary clowns, a national panic attack. The fever broke out in August when a Columbia, South Carolina apartment manager told authorities men dressed as clowns had been beckoning local children into nearby woods, said Tim Walker in independent.co.uk. Other reports cropped up around the city, including one of a clown with a blinking nose seen near a dumpster. The claims were unsubstantiated, but the news went viral, and around the country, pranksters donned clown costumes to spook people. Now a clown panic has gripped the U.S. In recent weeks, authorities have been forced to investigate scary clown sightings in 39 states. Some were credible. In 18 states, perpetrators in clown garb have been arrested for menacing people or making threats. Still, the vast majority of reports have been the product of either hysteria or hoaxes. People who are genuinely intent on malice don't want to be caught, says clown historian Ben Radford. If you're dressed as a clown, you stand out. Cops just have to follow the size 38 footprints. This is no laughing matter, said Andrea Pizer in the New York Post. Certainly not for the 12% of U.S. adults who suffer from crippling coulrophobia, fear of clowns. It's also not funny to the cops, who are wasting time on scary clown sightings. In a country full of guns, police also fear an outbreak of vigilantism, said Suzanne Zuppello in RollingStone.com. What if spooked gun owners decide to end the clown problem on their own? An outraged Randy Christensen, president of the World Clown Association, says faux clowns and hoaxers are taking something innocent and wholesome and perverting it to create fear. Actually, the idea of a good clown is fairly new, said Olivia Waxman in Time.com. In the 17th century, clowns and jesters were troublemakers. In the Pickwick Papers, Dickens famously portrayed a clown as a sinister, white-faced drunkard with florid hair. During the Cold War, clown historians say, widespread anxiety fueled a demand for jolly clowns like Bozo and Ronald McDonald. But things took a dark turn in the 1980s. A panic over a few high-profile child abductions fueled fear of strangers in disguise, and Stephen King's horror novel It enshrined the evil clown in pop culture. Now King is trying to ease the very terror he helped inspire, tweeting, "Time to cool the clown hysteria. Most of them are good. Cheer up the kiddies. Make people laugh." And we'll finish up with some shorter notes. People who still live in their hometown are much more likely to vote for Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump than for Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. 40% of Trump's likely voters live in the community where they spent their youth, compared with just 29% of Clinton voters. Nearly half of men ages 25 to 54 who've given up looking for a job take pain medication on a daily basis, a new Princeton University study found. In two-thirds of those cases, they take highly addictive prescription pain medication. The weight of the average American reaches an annual low this time of year, according to a new Cornell University study. Most people then experience a long weight climb through Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Christmas, and New Year, peaking on New Year's Day. This 10-week pound pile-on takes on average of 5 months to lose. Democrats employ at least 4,200 people working to elect presidential nominee Hillary Clinton from campaign headquarters and in battleground states, compared with 880 paid staffers working for the Republicans. New York officials are installing special cameras at 10 bridges and tunnels into Manhattan to read license plates and capture images of drivers' faces. The license plate readers and facial recognition cameras will be connected to databases of suspected terrorists and criminals. After a recording, this is on the Poll Watch, after a recording of Donald Trump's comments about women was released, 69% of women said they did not think Trump respects women. 55% of men agreed. 81% of Republicans and Republican-leaning likely voters said Trump's comments would not change their vote, but 31% of independents said they're less likely to vote for him. Also on the Poll Watch, 70% of American voters believe that this year's presidential campaign has brought out the worst in people. And we'll finish up with a quote. This is from author Henry David Thoreau. He says, "Beware of all enterprises that require new clothes." And with that, we'll finish up. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is available as a podcast right after the program at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call. 919-832-5138.